It's 2:42. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Journalist George Weller, a legendary Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent for the Chicago Daily News, was the first Allied journalist to reach Nagasaki after the atomic bomb struck the city on August 9, 1945. He entered Nagasaki a few days after having covered the September 2nd surrender of Japan aboard the U.S. battleship Missouri. Weller was also the first reporter to enter nearby Allied POW camps. But Weller's dispatches on Nagasaki and the POW camps didn't make it into the paper. They were stopped by U.S. censors, and Weller thought they were forever lost. But a few months after George Weller's death in 2002, at the age of 95, his son, Anthony Weller, discovered fragile carbon copies of the reports. They have now been published as First Into Nagasaki, the Censored Eyewitness Dispatches on Post-Atomic Japan and Its Prisoners of War. Anthony Weller edited and provided an introductory essay for the book. He has also worked as a journalist. In addition, he is a novelist and a musician, and he is my guest in this portion of the program. Anthony Weller, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
How did you find your father's reports from Japan?
Well, I was going through an enormous room prior to renovating the house, and this room was full up to my armpits in chaotic papers and crates and boxes of spanning my father's 60 years as a journalist, and I was hoping against hope that they might be there somewhere, and sure enough, at the bottom of a wooden crate, there they were, moldering and crumbling and yellowed and all out of order, but still there.
What a moment.
Yeah.
What do you recall most vividly from your first reading of these dispatches?
Well, I'm afraid that the thing I most remember was not really being able to make much sense of them, because they were written in a kind of telegram language which journalists of the day used. There were no cell phones, and they couldn't afford to call their newspapers, so they sent their dispatches by cable, and naturally, to save money on cable fees, they were used to writing in this abbreviated telegram language, which on first glance doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But I knew when I saw a Nagasaki, and that first line about walk in Nagasaki streets and you walk in ruins, that was certainly a eureka moment for me.
Yeah, yeah. The war was over, but General Douglas MacArthur had placed all of southern Japan off limits to
right.
the press.
Right.
When did your father decide he would defy MacArthur and go into either Hiroshima or Nagasaki?
Well, he decided immediately, because right after the signing on board the Missouri, all the hundreds of foreign correspondents who were there, who had just been informed that they couldn't even walk around Tokyo, which, as you remember, had been firebombed very heavily in the spring of 1945, he was shepherded into a big room, and the journalists were told where they could go now. If they didn't want to stick around Yokohama, they could go to northern Japan, but nobody was allowed to southern Japan at all, and especially not to the bomb sites where the war had been decided. There was, however, one junket going down to an abandoned kamikaze base at the very south of Kyushu, the southernmost island of Japan, and it was represented as being of very little interest, but my father had this notion that if he could get down there, he could maybe slip away from his army handlers and get on a train that might run him northward to either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. So that's what he did. He flew down there. He was the only journalist who did, and he slipped away in the night and got a local boatman to row him across to the mainland, and he found his way to a train station and took about a dozen trains until he got to Nagasaki.
Hmm. What were his first impressions?
Well, his first impressions were that the city had been bombed, but not sort of flattened beyond recognition, which is the popular and true image of Hiroshima. in fact, what had happened in Nagasaki, because the city was essentially rimmed by hills, was that the blast didn't do nearly as much damage as in Hiroshima. What did the damage were the fires that broke out as a result of the blast. A lot of the houses were wood and immediately caught fire. So in a way, it was a Dresden. It wasn't a Hiroshima. And whole parts of the city were intact, but of course a great deal of it was absolutely burned up, including all the arms plants, which were the city's real reason for being.
Yeah, and a month later, after the bomb had struck the city, people were still dying. That also struck him.
Absolutely. He tried as soon as possible to get into the hospitals where this correspondent, who of course had seen no end of bloodshed and destruction in the course of the war, he'd been around for the fall of Greece, the fall of Singapore, the fall of Java, etc., he was still immediately aware that he was seeing something that nobody had ever seen before, which he called Disease X in his dispatches, but was in fact a radiation sickness.
Hmm. Over time, how did your father feel about the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Well, I think it's safe to say he had very mixed feelings. At one point, he characterized his feelings that he felt pity immediately, but having seen a great deal of the war with Japan, he did not feel remorse. That said, he was always very careful to place the Nagasaki in context, meaning that he was astounded that nobody spoke about the firebombings of Tokyo, for example, which killed more people on one night than Nagasaki did, and arguably than Hiroshima did. He felt there was something about the nature of the atom bomb that prevented people from looking at it with any clarity. And, of course, when he got there, he was absolutely furious about what he saw, because he felt that MacArthur had no right to tell him not to go. The war was over. The Japanese were no longer our enemies. So he, as a journalist, could go wherever he wanted. By the same token, since we were no longer at war with the Japanese, he was really angry that many weeks after the bomb had dropped, there was still no medical aid being given to these people. And the Japanese doctors, who were very astute, had already cataloged the effects of the ray on people, and they were simply waiting for the Americans to send medical aid. And we didn't send any aid for 6 weeks. So this was something that really stayed with him.
Yeah. As I mentioned, he also went on to nearby POW camps, and there were some POWs right there in Nagasaki.
Right.
Tell us about your dad's entrance into the POW camp at Omura.
Well, it was a dramatic moment, because these prisoners had been working essentially as slave labor in coal mines, which had been declared unsafe decades before, and he found that these men did not know the war was over. They had an inkling it might be over because some of their Japanese guards had fled, but they did not believe that this necessarily meant they were safe. They thought it might be a trap, and that if they tried to leave the camp, they would be machine gunned. So my father walked into camp and informed the men that the war was over, that they were free men, and told the Japanese commandant that the men had to be freed. So for me, one of the poignant aspects of this book was getting letters from some of these men now in their 80s who had very clear memories of hearing from my father that the war was over. And of course, what he was able to do was write down their recollections of 3.5 years of slavery there and torture before memory had sicklied over their recollections. So part of the book is a very vivid series of interviews with these men who've just learned that they're free that very day.
Yeah. It seems to me the story of the Allied POWs held by the Japanese remains today a story largely untold.
I think that's true.
Why do you suppose that is the case?
I think part of it is the sheer brutality of it is something very difficult to convey, certainly in the movies, which are where most people get their history. I mean, the Japanese POW camps were 7 times deadlier than the Nazi POW camps. I'm not speaking about the concentration camps, of course, but we all know movies like The Great Escape. There was nothing like that possible in the Japanese camps. Any white man who tried to escape would have been instantly visible as a white face in Asia. And it's a pretty brutal story. And at the same time, I think there was a concerted effort, because we were so intent on rebuilding Japan, not to hear this story. I mean, many POWs were forced by the U.S. government to sign documents that they wouldn't talk about their experiences. So, you know, it's a fairly complex tale of how these sagas get erased from history.
Mm-hmm. The first part of the book includes a piece written by your father in the 1960s.
Right.
It's an article he wrote for an anthology of reporters' memoirs.
Uh-huh. Right.
And one of the things he wrote about was his contempt for military censorship once the war had ended. And this is something you alluded to a little while ago.
Yeah.
He also held in contempt what we have come to call spin.
Uh-huh.
He wrote, "The dam was to be opened to one last orgy of hometown stories more mindless and more alike than the slow molasses drippings of 4 years of sloppy, apolitical, dear mom war." Wow.
Yeah.
What did your dad think of MacArthur and this censorship and this manipulation of media?
Well, I think for him, this story, which continued to haunt him for the rest of his life, was the final straw. I mean, he and all the other reporters had been censored mercilessly for years, and I think he had hoped, as the first reporter under MacArthur's aegis to win a Pulitzer, that he might get a little special treatment. And this was certainly not to be. MacArthur had killed story after story that he'd written and sent directives to reporters telling them that their job was not to criticize the commander-in-chief. And I think he felt a general frustration with the inability of Americans to think politically, to really think about what they were doing overseas. And, of course, in the war of censorship, he lost. You know, all these stories were censored and were censored out of existence. And if they weren't censored at the MacArthur end, they were often censored back home. I mean, Truman sent a directive a few days after my dad got to Nagasaki, demanding that all the print and broadcast media of the United States not discuss the bomb for reasons of national security. So this is nothing new, and you know, it's just the version of it today has to be different, because you can't stop a cell phone, but you can still limit access, and that's how you do it.
Yeah. For today, Anthony, this is where we have to leave it. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anthony Weller. He is the son of George Weller, the legendary Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, prize-winning correspondent for the Chicago Daily News. George Weller was the first Allied journalist to reach Nagasaki after the atomic bomb struck the city in August of 1945. He was also the first reporter to enter nearby Allied POW camps. His work was censored. It was feared forever lost. But Anthony Weller came across it in his father's papers, these dispatches, and now they've been published first into Nagasaki, the censored eyewitness dispatches on post-atomic Japan and its prisoners of war. The publisher is Crown.